Welcome to this audio sermon presented by Blue Letter Bible. Due to the fragile nature of cassette tape storage, a portion from the end of this teaching became inaudible. Fortunately, we do not believe any of the spiritual content or the applications contained within the rest of this message have been affected. We thank you for listening, and may the Lord richly bless the time you spend in His Word.
A movie came out, I'd say it was 2.5 to 3 years ago. Most of us probably saw it. It was entitled Chariots of Fire. How many did see that, out of curiosity? Yes, a lot of us did see that. It was interesting. It surprised me, although I was excited, that it made Picture of the Year. And what was unique about that is it had some strong Christian messages coming out through not only the scripture that was read and quoted in the movie, but through the lifestyle of one person in particular, but others related to him as well. And as I thought about that, well, why did that movie do so well? Out of all the movies that were showing, why was that rated number one? And I think there are certain things about it that people were drawn to. One was, it was a true story. We appreciate that. Another was that there was a message of hope. It was a positive movie. Another was, it was realistic. And yet it was not realistic to show the filth of the day, but to show the real-life struggles and the depths of the effort that men put into finding out the meaning of life. And yet I think for the Christian community, the greatest thing about that movie was that God's name was brought out and His Word was read, some of the neatest passages of Scripture, and He received the glory. Now, I've got a story here this morning we're going to look at, I think would make a great movie. Has anybody ever made a movie out of this? Have they? They have. I didn't know that. Tammy and I couldn't remember that they had. I think it would, if they did it right, it has the same kind of content. In fact, the content is even better than Chariots of Fire. And I think you know what I'm talking about, the story of Joseph. Maybe we should rephrase that. It isn't the story of Joseph, it's the story of Joseph's God and His sovereignty over the nations and over also the individual life of one man and how his life overlapped in the lives of others. That's what we're going to look at this morning. And as we do that, consider the fact that God has not ceased to be involved in the lives of men and women. See, He's writing out or revealing His story that He has already written out for you. Consider the providence of God in your life, as I do mine, as we compare our lives with Joseph. Now, there is a line of men that are mentioned in the Scriptures that I would like to mention to you. We're moving along and mentioning these people because the Messiah, this is the line of the Messiah. Christ comes through this line. And I want you to see how Joseph fits into this. Remember, we started out with, Adam, then Noah, and then one of the sons of Noah, Shem, and then the godly line passes down through Abraham, and then Isaac, and then Isaac's son, Jacob, and then in between Jacob and Judah is the life and the story of Joseph. Now, Joseph was not in the godly line, did not pass through his family to his sons and so on. But it's interesting, God used him in a vital way, not only in his own personal family, but in ultimately the progression of the nation of Israel. Very important life. And then it passed down from Judah through David and so on. So that's where we are today. We're in the life of Joseph. Now we're talking about, as you can see on your outline, God's amazing providence. What is providence? I'd like to read a little definition to you. It says, God, the great creator of all things, doth uphold, direct, dispose, and govern all creatures, actions, and things, from the greatest even to the least, by His most wise and holy providence. What does He do? He upholds, directs, disposes, and governs just a few things, just the important people like Joseph, just the President of the United States, No, it says all creatures, actions, and things, from the greatest even to the least. We all fit in. We are all a part of the providential working of God. And we could spend hours and days together, I think, sharing of as we look back on our lives and to see how God led me here and how He spoke to us there and what He taught us through this. It would fit in beautifully. Well, let's compare it as we look at Joseph's family. First of all, Joseph and his family in chapter 37. I'm going to read a little bit there so we get some background to this. Now, Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the genealogy of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. Take note of that. He's 17. Later on, we're going to find out how old he is. And it's interesting to see how many years elapsed. The story didn't happen in a period of 2 weeks, you see. It took place over a lifetime. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. A real problem, we see, this comes out, this colored robe. It's the symbol of, you are the special one. And he didn't just show him by telling him. He put on a multicolored robe on him, so the kid walks around with his robe on, and the brothers, all they see is, I don't know, red, white, blue, green, whatever it was. You can imagine how irritating that was to them to see not only the kid, but the symbol he was wearing is, I'm the favorite of my father. And you will find their response. It says, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So real internal strife in this family. Now Joseph dreamed a dream and he told it to his brothers and they hated him even more. He wasn't too wise, I think, how he approached sharing his dreams. He says, please, hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. Boy, how to make yourself popular in one short story. And his brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream. And he said, maybe I should keep it to myself because things aren't going so well. No, he wasn't smart enough or mature enough to know how to approach the situation. He says, look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And notice it says in verse 11, his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. His brothers hated him, they couldn't speak peaceably to him, and they envied him. Now envy says, it's not I want what you have. It's I don't want you to enjoy what you've got. They didn't want him to prosper. And this, I think, over a period of time, built up within them, and finally it came out. And in verse 12, it says, his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, go to your brothers and let me know how they are doing. Well, he is walking along, and it says they see him from afar off in verse 18. There's the kid. How could they miss him? 3 miles down the road, they see the colored robe walking along. And here's what they're thinking, and they're sharing with one another. They conspired, it says, against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. Now Reuben, the eldest, stands up and says, let's not shed his blood. Let's just put him in this pit, but don't shed his blood. And basically, he wins out. And what he is thinking is, later on I'll come back and I'll save his life. I mean, this can't take place. We can't murder our own brother. And Reuben left, And he, during that time, they sold their brother to the Ishmaelites, that were some traders were passing by from another land, and they sold him for 20 pieces of silver. And then it says in 29, Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" Everybody on the street knew whose tunic it was. And it's interesting, you follow the consistent character of the brothers, and their character does not change from this page all the way to chapter 50. They are deceiving, and they are out for themselves, and they're the kind of guys, if I lived with, I wouldn't turn my back to them very often, because they could not be trusted. Now look at verse 36. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Great. Here's the picture. Joseph and his family. What a great setting. He's 17 years old. He's about a senior in high school. It's amazing when I think of that, because I think of the average senior in high school and them going through something like this, a life experience like this. It just is mind-boggling. You have to attribute the life of Joseph to God's grace from beginning to end. For him to do what he did and the faithfulness that he exhibited, it was the sovereign hand of God upon him. Joseph dreams these two dreams, and he's not mature enough to realize things aren't going well. Let me maybe share it with my dad out in the field one-on-one and see what he thinks I ought to do about it. Instead, he proceeds, and his brothers envy and they hate him. So much so, as it builds up, they want to take his very life. They don't do that. They throw him into the pit. He finds himself then taken and sold for only 20 pieces of silver to these foreign traders, and he's thinking, what in the world is going on? I have nothing against my brothers. Life's going great for me. I haven't done anything wrong. And now I find myself bound and taken to a foreign country. What? Why me, Lord? Why did you do such a thing to me? Why do my own brothers turn against me? He's sold for 20 pieces of silver, and he finds himself working for a man by the name of Potiphar, captain of the guard. And so you see, at 17 years old, I'm sure at that age you've got a lot of dreams. I did. Most people do. But his dreams have just gone out the window. His family relationship is shattered and broken, and he finds himself in a foreign country, probably can't speak a word of their language, scared to death. What am I going to do now? A captive. Now, that seems almost too much to believe. If that would happen to someone today, it's like someone today being sold by their brothers and he finds himself in Iran going, oh my goodness, different culture, different language. What am I going to do? Well, let's see how God takes him, or where he takes him, what he does with him. And we'll look at Act 2 here. Joseph working for Potiphar in chapter 39. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Now notice this. These are great verses. The Lord was with Joseph. See, Joseph wasn't alone, and that's the hope that we have. No matter what, he is with us. I'm sure he didn't feel it at all. But whether he felt it or not, it is a fact. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him. And I've got in my Bible written there, grace. That's what it was. And that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house and all that he had put in his hand. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Why would they mention that? Hollywood movie would play that up, I'm sure. But God didn't mention it for that reason. We'll find out why in just a couple moments. But notice that his life looks like major tragedy. But then in the beginning of 39, God is with him, and we see good come out of evil. In fact, God is advancing him, and he doesn't even know it. God may be advancing you through the worst circumstances, through the greatest pressure, or the deepest trials. And you might be saying, no, I'm going backwards. This is goofing up my whole life. It stopped me. And how can I perform the will of God through this? God may be advancing you. That's what he was doing with Joseph. And things were beginning to go well. Maybe he was beginning to make the adjustment, and he could speak a few words of their language. He was picking it up. And he's going, well, if this is where I am, I'm going to make the best of it. He seemed to be that kind of a guy because he got in there and he worked hard and he remained faithful to his God. But life isn't that easy. And he lived happily ever after. We wish it would read that, but it doesn't. Because then we move on in the chapter and we see temptation. Verses 7 through 13. Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me, but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was, well, we'll stop right there. Let me make a couple comments and then we'll see so it was. Interesting story. We could spend the whole morning just on this passage. Because you see, this isn't far-fetched. This is taking place in our modern-day society all of the time. In fact, Tammy and I know of a situation where one of the roommates in this particular place on the island, one of the girls is dating a married man, and she's doing everything she can to get him to leave her wife or his wife and children and marry her. You see, it's part of the culture, or supposedly people want us to believe. And yet notice how he deals with the situation. He didn't put himself in that situation, but he made the best of it. And when she began to come on to him, he remained steadfast, and he finally said, listen, I cannot sin against your husband, and more importantly than that, I can't sin against God. Did that stop her? No. It's interesting. Temptation isn't just once and that's it. Many times it will wear on you and come back from different ways, different shapes, different forms. And yet, he could have said during that period of time, you know what? My master trusts me completely. He's out of town on business. And this, in fact, could even help my relationship with, you know, his wife would love me and he loves me and everything would go great. And nobody's around. Nobody would know. And yet he realized something that we need to realize, that God knows, and that every sin that we commit is first and foremost against our Lord. It's against God. And that is what kept him strong in a very, very difficult situation. And so what was his response? When it finally came to the point, she grabbed hold of his jacket, and what did he do? He didn't hesitate for a second. He fled the situation. You see, temptation would love for us to sit around and have a conversation with it. Well, let me at least take you out to lunch. I don't want you to think that I'm not a gentleman. Let me take you out to lunch. And no, he didn't do that. Not lunch, not dinner, not a conversation, nothing. I've got to get out of here, and I will do whatever I can to flee the situation because I'm faithful to my God. And so he did. Amazing story, because that is one of the needs of the day, to to flee the temptations that bombard us. Obedience. Notice 12 and 13. He fled, and she saw that he had left in his garment or in her hand and fled outside. Now you'd think in this act of obedience, God would say, that was my test. Now I'm going to show you just great blessings and great advancement and so on. At least we would think that. But then we see the third part of the story. The plot thickens. Instead of good happening to him, evil happens to him. Because then he's placed in prison. And notice what takes place. It's horrible from the human perspective. She called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came into me to mock me," and so on. And notice the response of the man. "And so it was when the master heard the words which his wife spoke to him," I think it's a pretty normal response, "your servant did to me after this manner, his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison." Okay, there we have it. Instead of a turn for the good because of his faithfulness and his obedience to God, it appears it's a turn for the worse. He at least went and worked for Potiphar in Egypt. That wasn't as bad as it could be. Now he finds himself in a jail in Egypt. So instead of it going like this, his life seems to be steadily going, getting worse, even though it appears that he is remaining faithful to the Lord. He was definitely a witness to this man as he worked for him. But I think this is another step of God's advancement. Humanly speaking, we can't figure it out. But God is not wasting our lives. He's not wasting our time. Notice verses 21 to 3. "But the Lord was with Joseph," and that's all he needed, "and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper." Amazing story. God is saying, is there any situation in life that I cannot turn around for my glory, that I am not in control of? But I don't think this happened as soon as Joseph walked into the prison. I doubt that. I doubt that the guy saw the halo over the top of his head and said, "Huh, this is a special guy. He will bless my prison business here." I don't think so. I think he went in there with the proper attitude, an attitude of a servant, and did what he was told. And over a process of time, this man recognized the qualities in this young man. I don't know how long. Maybe he was there a couple years or more. No one, it does not tell us. But I think it's interesting also, I call this God's overlapping providence. You see, God doesn't just work in my life and it's like a tunnel I'm walking through. My life overlaps with yours and yours with mine. And that's what takes place here. You see, the Lord's working in somebody else's life here too. And he overlaps them, preparing Joseph for yet another advancement. And we move into the next chapter. It talks about the butler and the baker. There's always a butler in every good movie. The butler and the baker. And I want you to notice, let me just read a little at the beginning of it for you so you can see how Joseph approaches these people. Excuse me. "It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined." Just chance, I guess. "And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he..." What did he do? He lorded it over them. No, my Bible says he served them. That's interesting. The way of advancement is humility, and service. So they were in custody for a while. Then the butler and baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came in to them in the morning and looked at them and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of his Lord's house, saying, "Why do you look so sad today? You think you have a hard life. You think you've got a sad story to tell. Well, wait a minute. Sit down here, since you can't go anywhere anyway, and let me tell you about my life and what has happened to me. I'm just a young man." And he rambled on and on and on. Well, he didn't do that. He actually allowed them to share their sad stories with him. And they did. And notice what he did. He says in verse 8, Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" And it's interesting. In each opportunity or each place he finds himself, it is an opportunity to witness to his faith. And he uses the circumstances, not only through what he says, but how he works and his faithfulness. People sense that he is different for a reason. And God opens up doors for him to share that. He does the same for us, by the way, if we would be sensitive to that and open up our eyes, that in every area of life, we have opportunities to live as God's child. And here are their dreams. "Behold, in my dream a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. Joseph said to him," this is the interpretation of it, "the three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. I'm innocent. I shouldn't be here," is what he's saying. "For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, "I also was in my dream, and there I had 3 white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket there were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head." So Joseph answered and said, "This is the interpretation of it. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you." Whew. I bet the guy said, "Oh, I wish I hadn't asked." Joseph was also very faithful to interpret the dreams exactly as God told him. "Now it came to pass on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them." And note verse 23. Boy, it's if this was a movie and you were emotionally attached to the characters involved, I think your emotions would be going up and down like this, because you're going, yes, now this guy, here's the advancement, here's how it's going to work. Humanly speaking, we can see it. But look at verse 23. "Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." Oh, man. So Joseph could be, doesn't say what's going on, but he could very well be at rock bottom. My last hope. But instead of becoming bitter and saying, "Forget working for this guy in this prison. Why should I have the attitude that I have? Everything I do seems to get worse and worse and worse." He was forgotten. And yet, God had not forgotten him. And so Joseph remained faithful, and for the next 2 years, he worked hard. And then something took place. Pharaoh had a dream, actually had a couple dreams, and thank you very much. In chapter 41, Pharaoh has a couple dreams, and that happens to be Joseph's gift And so he dreams these dreams about seven fat cows, very healthy cows, and seven skinny cows, bony, gaunt, whatever you want to say. Then he has another dream about seven fat ears of corn and seven real skinny, scrawny ears of corn. And it really frustrates him. Can't get it off his mind. I don't know if you dream very much, but if you ever have a dream that is just so real, it's like you are there and you go through the whole day and you can't get this thing off your mind. It's like, I lived that. And yet I cannot stand some of the details of that dream. I wish I hadn't thought of that. And Pharaoh, I think, was struggling with dreams like this. And so he went to everybody in his kingdom and said, who can interpret such a dream? And all of his wise men and all of his advisors said, we can't interpret it. And what happens? God turns the light bulb on inside of the head of the butler. He's standing there and he has his, I don't know, a bottle of Rio Nitti or whatever he was pouring into the cup of the king. And he says, hey, wait a minute. There's a guy in prison that interpreted my dream and it came true exactly to the last detail. And so they brought him before Pharaoh. Now this is 2 years later that this is taking place. And what takes place? Well, he interprets a dream. Look at chapter 41, verse 33. Well, I will tell you the dream, and then I will tell you God's advancement. We'll do it that way. He basically says that the first seven cows symbolize 7 years of abundance, of plenty in the land of Egypt. And the seven gaunt, skinny cows symbolize famine, worse than you have ever seen before. And he says the same goes for the ears of corn. Now, God gives you two dreams because he is saying that he's going to bring it to pass and that it's going to take place exactly as said. So you are going to have 7 years of plenty, abundance, and then 7 years of unbelievable drought. Not just Egypt, but all the nations around about Egypt. And he doesn't stop there and walk out. You see, after a number of years of walking with the Lord and working with people and always being placed in positions of leadership, Joseph had grown. He had matured. He knew what to say in this circumstance because he then said, Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt that the land may not perish during the famine. So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? Big silence. And Joseph is standing there, hoping they'll notice him, I guess. Well, they do, and we know the story. It's an unbelievable story. From the depths of the dungeon, he is placed in the number 2 spot in Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. And it's the same story as it was with Potiphar and with the head jailer. They recognized the wisdom and ability in this man, that God was with him, and they simply handed over their total responsibility, knowing that all I have to do is put this guy in charge, and I personally am going to prosper as well. And the same exact thing took place here under Pharaoh himself. And so you see, God raises him in a very brief period of time to a position of wealth, of power, and as the story goes on, we find out he marries and he has 2 sons. God has that way of doing it, turning your life around. And this is what he is called for. Now, as we know, Joseph's brethren come back into his life as the chapters go on. Now, turn to chapter 42, or look at 42, and verses 8 and 9. Now, we're not going to get into all the details of them coming and then going home and all of that. I just want to pick out a few things about the character development that took place in Joseph and how God used him. 42:8-9. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. You know, from 17 years old up to, we'll see how old he is here. Well, actually, after the 7 years of abundance, he is approximately 39 years old. And so 22 years have gone by. 22 years have taken place in his life. So you can see why they probably didn't recognize him. Did they ever expect to see him as the most powerful man in their life? No, they never expected it. But notice verse 9. Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." Now, I think that's interesting. 22 years of letting it go over in your mind, and each time a bad circumstance takes place, you think, "My brothers did this to me." At least that could be the normal human response. 22 years of bitterness building up in one's heart. And now he's a very powerful man, could do anything he wanted with his brothers. What does he do? Well, he doesn't reveal himself, and he comes off in a tough and a very firm way. And he begins to ask them questions. And you know why I think he deals with them in this way? Because he doesn't trust them. He doesn't trust his brothers. And so he wanted to find out about his father and what was going on back at home. And so he did it in the manner that he did. Because you notice, instead of being bitter, he leaves the room and he breaks down and he cries. He's not a bitter man. He knows after 22 years that God is sovereignly in control of his life and God has a plan for him and he's walking in it. He's not bitter toward his brothers. And he asks in the passage about the youngest and about his father because he wants to know about them. And then he puts money in their sacks and gives them all the food that they can carry, and he sends them back. Notice, I want you to see one other passage here in chapter 45. In the story, they go home, they see the money, they're shocked. And the father says, "Oh boy, you boys, you're going to take my gray hairs down to Sheol," he says. That's how they talk in those days. And so they have to go back, and he talks to them again, and they have to bring their little brother Benjamin back with them. And what a struggle that they're going through. Notice how he reveals himself to them in chapter 45. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And then in verses, notice 9 to 15, they've talked a little bit. They're coming out of their shock a little bit. And he says, "Hasten and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, you shall be near me, you and your children, your children's children, your flocks and your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty. For there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and of all that you have seen, and you shall hasten and bring my father down here.' Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck." And notice this verse 15. "Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And after that, his brothers talked with him." What an amazing work of grace God had done and was doing in the life of Joseph. Because the story came true. But the attitude of the man was one of a servant and of compassion toward the very people who sold him into slavery. "I'll care for you," he said. It wasn't, "You see, remember the dreams? Remember what I said? See what you've done? I told you so." It wasn't that at all. It was, "I will care for you." Let's talk about by way of application, the end of God's providence. In 45, 5 through 8, he talks about that. He said, "But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here." He's consoling them. "For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting." And notice, "And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." God did it. And that was the power of his life. He saw the sovereign hand of God in everything that he did, the good and the bad. Notice also in 46, 1-3. "So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, 'Jacob, Jacob.' And he said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there." See, this is what God was doing. It was always in the mind of God. And he used Joseph as his tool to bring it about. And then in 47, verse 6, "The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and your brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock." And so God not only took care of them, but he gave them the best of the land. What took place in the life of Joseph? Let's notice some things. Well, first of all, he developed in character. And he received many personal blessings in walking with the Lord. It's obvious that he was a man of great character to be able to go through what he did, remain faithful, and then at the very end, continue to be a humble servant, even to his own brothers. Another thing is, he wasn't just simply blessed himself. See, we don't live in a vacuum. We talk about the body of Christ, or God's elect, or God's people. And we are not to live unto ourselves. That's not how Christianity is designed. We are called, once we come to know the Lord, to live unto others, to serve others, to be a blessing to others. And in fact, when we do that, we find ourselves. And Joseph learned this, and he became a blessing to his own family. He wasn't selfish, wasn't caught up in his own importance, but he took particular care of his own family. Another thing is this in turn went farther than that. It went beyond his own personal immediate family and blessed the people of God. They were placed in a great part of the land and in security during a very difficult famine. Also, the life of Joseph and what he had learned and the influence, the way that God used him, was to influence the ungodly around him. Stop and consider the great influence that he had. He did not live his life in a vacuum. He was not afraid to get involved with the non-Christian about him. He was not afraid to get involved in government and in politics. In fact, God put him in the most powerful position in Egypt. And he was not afraid to tell people, "I'm a believer. I believe in God. And the reason why he prospers me, or why I prosper, is because of him." And I think the wisdom that he used to govern was he governed from God's principles that God had taught him. So his life affected the lives of non-believers around him. Right down to the point when you read about Jacob's death in the last part of the book, it said not only did Joseph and the family mourn, but the Egyptians mourned with them as well. What an impact. What about our own lives? We study these passages together. The worst thing that we could do this morning is say, you know, that's a neat story in the Bible. It is. It's fun to read, and it's great to see God working. But let's not leave here and think that it doesn't relate to me. God may not make you president of the United States, you know, down the road. It may not take place. But you know what? Each of us are one little strand that fits in and paints that beautiful tapestry that God is creating. Look at your life, even the dark moments, as Joseph did. God meant it for good and is meaning it for good. Now, you can't do that by your feelings. We've got to do it by our faith. Our lives are planned. That's the first point. He has a specific plan. Secondly, tragedy and blessings are equally a part of God's providence.
Unfortunately, at this point in the original tape, the remainder of the message was not recoverable. Therefore, this is the end of the message. God bless you, and we hope you found this tape useful in your study of God's Word.